So we're going to start this lecture from up here, as that and the board says. Okay? Largely because I want you all to turn round. Hi. That was slightly worrying. How are you doing? Are you self-conscious right now, right? So what am I trying to do? I'm trying to make a cheap, shallow, giggy point right at the beginning of a lecture on self-conscious fiction to ask you to think about how self-conscious you're feeling right now at the fact that the lecture isn't taking place in the conventional space that you expect the lecture to take place in, right? None of you, because your necks would hurt, and because the whole spatial arrangement of the room is towards the front, would want me to continue being up here, would you? No, no, no. See, you nodded your head too quickly, didn't you, like that? Because now you're worried I'm going to ask you a question, aren't you? What's your name?
Emily.
Okay, Emily. Why do you think, no. So it's not a seminar, is it? It's a lecture. You don't expect me to break that frame, do you? You don't expect me to kind of pierce through that whole kind of like alienation effect that you yourself are quite happy holding on to, right? You don't want me to say things to you to point you out. You're all slightly nervous when I walk by. Yeah, I know, Prima, I know what you're saying. So what am I doing, right? I'm frame breaking. And that's really, in many ways, what we're going to think about today. Because we all know, you're all big time modernist Charlies now, right? You've all went through the whole realist thing. You've all went through the whole modernist thing in year one. We all know that fiction, all fiction, right, is self-conscious. It's clear that that's the case. And here's the cliche, right, some fiction, of course, is more self-conscious than other fiction. But nonetheless, it doesn't mean to say that we can't not look for modes of self-consciousness in all fiction. Now, why would we want to do that? And is there a particular era, say, for example, in critical scholarship that would ask us to think about why it might be important to do that, as opposed to other eras, for example. But the most important thing is frame breaking, right? That's the first thing to think about. Why do I have to come down here? Why do I even have to put that up to make you feel even more self-conscious? That all the way through this lecture, quote unquote, I want you to think about what the normative element of pedagogic scholarship is in relation to the novel form too, obviously, right? Because of course, we read novels, we read literature for something, for some kind of effect. What that might be, novelists want you to think about. It might not appear apparent initially when you're reading a novel, it might not appear apparent at all until you get to the end of it, or never at all. The point of the self-conscious novel and looking for self-consciousness in novels is to ask us to think about why it might be important to think about their self-consciousness, all right? So are you in the right place for this lecture? That's the question. You expect me to do certain things here, the way that you expect novels to begin the same way, to have certain functions, structures, and so on. You expect realist novels to do certain things, you expect modernist novels to do certain things, and postmodern novels. That's clear. But what happens when those expectations are broken? And to what extent do we have to get meta about that? Because we can get lost in this, right? Postmodern novels, which have almost become artifacts now in literary history, and I'll say a little bit more about that later on, quite happily ask you to think about how redundant it is, even to think about how redundant it is to write a novel about other novels, or where it's just all a fiction, where you're utterly aware from the beginning that everything is a fiction and it doesn't really mean anything. And that's why some people look at postmodern fiction as actually a form that was initially quite exciting, but has now kind of proved rather exhausted and moribund in its overuse of pastiche, irony, and so on, right? So let's carry on this nonsense. Now, we're not supposed to say things like this in lectures, are we? We really aren't. I'm not going to pick up my coffee and pour it over Videhi, am I? I could. I might get that far, but I'm really just not going to do it, am I? Right? Because you don't expect me to do it. I'm trying to break conventions, trying to break expectations. But when we get to a point where even that itself is something expected, it becomes a problem. Now, we're not at that stage yet. But and in many ways we may have actually passed through that stage by the trajectory of the novel form from the 19th to the 21st century. And of course we can argue about whether or not that exists in other spaces of the world other than Europe, for example, but you know, we'll get on to that. So anyway, blah, 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 right? What am I talking about? I'm talking about a mode of fiction that became increasingly apparent to us all from about the 1970s onwards, because it became critically trendy. No, that's the wrong word. That's a wee bit, that's not nice. It became critically significant, right? Salient in some respects, to think about where the novel was going as a form. It felt moribund after the breaks of modernism. And in addition to an increasing kind of like division of labor, an increasing kind of like globalization of media, and the rise in many respects of mediatized consciousness throughout the late 50s and of course throughout the 1960s rapidly, right? The media society grew up, people were kind of like interested in the idea of how this was going to affect on truth discourses, reality discourses, and so on. Metafiction became increasingly apparent as a critical form to think about the novel, not just the 1960s novel, the 1970s novel in and through. If you think about it, in many respects, metafiction, as I've said, is part of the realist novel. It's just not apparent. That's one of the things that I think I want to get across to you today. Now, think about what we've told you in many respects about realism, right? The classic exemplar here is Flaubert. Flaubert, who seeks a kind of beautiful, pure realist form, right? We're insistent on things like metaphor and description being absolutely absent from the novel, where what you get is a kind of circulation of kind of like discourses and characters and perspectives that open everything up, but in a rather surface fashion. And I know that that may be kind of contradictory to some of the things you've thought about with Madame Bovary, but I want to try and explain that later. But Flaubert's main aim is to hide the narrator, right? Get rid of the narrator. Hence, of course, the importance of indirect discourse, of stil indirect libre for Flaubertian fiction. The notion that there wouldn't be a kind of commanding figure in the background authoritatively telling us stuff about characters as such. It just kind of seemed to happen. And of course, in some respects, in a vulgar fashion, if realism is going to pursue the kind of neutral element of its reflective capacities and judgments and statements that realists said it would, then that's a good thing, right? We don't want to be reminded in some respects that there's this kind of like line between fiction and quote-unquote reality, truth. But of course, the thing that's nagged us all, right, has been the ism in realism. It's not the real, even though the real itself is being pursued. It's always been shunted or reprocessed, represented as such in a mode called realism, which of course approximates reality, historical reality at any particular moment in time, right? That's the idea. Believable figures, a degree of verisimilitude, a high degree in accordance with Zola and so on and so forth, chronological order, characters that seem to be pulled from recognizable types in everyday life and so on. We know that stuff, right? The mode of the realist novel. Now, there's a very famous novel in the cycle, the Rougon-Macquart cycle, by Zola, called L'Oeuvre. Okay, it means the masterpiece, effectively. It's about Cézanne. Some of you in my seminar group, I talked a little bit about this. At the end of that novel, Zola appears. He's not called Zola, but it's a kind of acronym. The character's name's a kind of acronym of him. It's very obvious it's him. And he appears at the funeral of the artist, the Cézanne figure, at the center of the novel, right? And this artist has been trying to paint Paris from all angles, in every perspective, in every weather, at all times of the year. He tries to paint one spot, l'Île de la Cité. Now, the argument here is, for him, that realism hasn't worked. It's just not done well enough. He has to get a new technique, a new style, a heightened form of observation and application to really capture the essence of reality at one particular moment in time. And of course, the whole exercise itself is killed from the start. It's fateful from the start. And at the end of that novel, after the guy dies, he hangs himself on the frame of the painting that he's been trying to paint. Sorry, but it doesn't really ruin the novel. Zola makes a speech, the Zola character, the author, makes a speech, and he says, we've been promised everything, we've tried to be exhaustive about everything, we've tried all manner of documentation, but it hasn't worked. Still, there's something that's not quite there. And they're not quite there, of course. This is looked upon in many respects in the logical progression of genre in the novel as a key statement in the movement towards a much more looser inflection of styles we now know, of course, as modernism, right? And we also know the hoary old argument about modernism, which continues and will continue beyond this date and well beyond the next 10 years or so, whether or not it's a continuation, a strengthening in some respects, on a microscopic level of realist concerns, right? Through ultra forms of subjectivity, for example, through ordinariness, through its complete fascination with the mundane moment, and so on, or it's a break in some respects. It's a giving up of that great realist project. And, of course, in modernism, we have a much more reflective apparatus that appears. The novel begins to question itself as a novel form, as a piece of language, as a form of mediated reality, as a text, as such. And it doesn't just do so because it's kind of fashionable. It does so for ontological reasons, for theoretical reasons, and also, of course, inevitably, for social and political reasons. Okay, there is a great kind of insecurity that pervades. I mean, some of you who've been looking at maybe the Gothic novel, for example, will know that there's a kind of fin de siècle worry, an anxiety, if you like, about the great 19th century social project. It seems to be kind of falling to bits. And again, of course, the history of modernism in many respects, because it comes from the calamity of the First World War, tends to work well with that kind of like that narrative. Right? We're kind of insecure about the kind of knowledge that's being produced as such. That's one argument for a different mode of fiction to be produced, and one argument for writers themselves to worry about the anxieties of the practice, right? The point of the practice. And of course, this is a potted history, but we're going to look at examples in the second half of the lecture how they attribute to self-consciousness in the novels that we're looking at. We get to a point even in itself, so the story runs, where modernism itself runs out of steam. Run about the 1950s, 1960s, at the same point as, of course, different media and mediums, importantly, television, cinema, of course, are all up and running by this stage, challenging the novel form as an attention grabber in the world of fiction, right? Of mediations of either life or art or whatever. So we've traveled somewhat further from Flaubert, okay? But we'll come back to him. Now, this is in some respects what Patricia was saying, and this is a great book about metafiction. Mark Curry's book is, if you want to go and look for it there, right? I mean, this is the book to look for, because there's a lot of different essays on why it comes about. But Patricia Waugh is a particularly authoritative one. She says, it's partly a consequence of an increased social and cultural self-consciousness. Beyond this, however, it also reflects a greater awareness within contemporary culture of the function of language in constructing and maintaining our sense of everyday reality. Metafiction explicitly lays bare the conventions of realism. Later on she says, it re-examines the conventions of realism in order to discover a fictional form that's culturally relevant. And that's important for me and for our purposes, I think. What is culturally relevant about fiction that talks about itself only as fiction? Is it not just completely introverted, imminent, self, you know, redundant in some respects? If all novels talk about as just novels, then where are we to go with novels as such? Well, of course, my big argument here is to go back to what Waugh says and to rethink what she says when she talks about how metafiction explicitly lays bare the conventions of realism, but it does not ignore or abandon them. There is some appertaining to the real in realism, in modernism, and in postmodernism. Even if there's a much more heightened sense of reality or realism, then that's fine. I mean, we're all pretty much au fait with this these days, right? We've all been through the whole Big Brother 90s decade of, what's it called? What's the type of television that Big Brother is? Oh, it's neither you do. Yeah, you charlatan. Reality TV, that's right. That's what it's called, right? When it got to such an unbelievable point that we were amazed at the kind of like mundanity of it all, right? There was a shocking point in Big Brother, for example. I'm often one, but I don't care, right? Where they went 24 hours. They just had cameras, and you could switch on a particular channel at any point in Big Brother to watch anything at all. That was the assumption, right? You can watch Big Brother. You can watch them up from every angle at any point in time. You can just switch the TV on and watch these people in this house with cameras on them. And this, in a sense, was being sold to you as the really real life of the candidates in the House, which we knew was already a fabrication, a fiction. And we held the dynamic, the tension of that always in our mind as viewers, right? But of course, when you looked at 24 Hour Big Brother, it was fundamentally boring, right? I mean, it was like someone, well, actually, I thought it was kind of cool in some respects. It was a wee bit Beckettian. It was like a Beckettian novel, one of kind of Beckett's later novels where people don't do much at all very much. There's a lot of concentration on people maybe doing this. And that would take a long time. I mean, I really would, you know. And then they would maybe pick their nose or do something really, you know, dull, right? And this was not entertainment in some respects, but it was reality nonetheless. And what this has done is, of course, it kickstarts a whole genre where we are suddenly sold the idea that this is reality TV, but we know that it's not. We hold that fiction of its fiction in our minds, and we worry about the tension between one another. And that can be enormously productive, that tension, the awareness of when we're being sold the idea of reality as such, or an approximation of it, because we tend to test reality through that, right, through other evidentiary forms. And in many ways, that's why the novel has been an exemplary form for this type of thing. So let's just look at a couple of classic examples from postmodernism. Some of you will know these. This one. Italo Calvino's If in a Winter's Night, a Traveller. I wanted to look at two novels of the postmodern genre, postmodernism, right? One of which shows two classic, both of which show classic moves in metafiction. One is the idea of the reader as a kind of surrogate figure in the text. You're suddenly invited into the text as such. The narrator speaks directly to you. And this isn't a new thing, right? Those of you that have been reading, I'm sure, you know, Chaucer onwards, Shakespeare and so on and so forth, are aware of addresses to the reader at some point. We've already been here, right, with some of the appendices and some of the epigraphs, for example, from Tolstoy, Dickens, Goethe's editor is a good example, right? We're all being manipulated in some respects by those kind of figures who are kind of shady characters in and out the text, who seem to straddle both worlds of the text. So in many senses, this is not new, but the direct address, even in a sense, is somewhat reminiscent of the novel as it fires into being in the 18th century, but it kind of, there's a load of prefaces like this in some respects where, you know, like the editor of, for example, of the author of Tom Jones, pretty much before every chapter in Fielding's Tom Jones says things like, you're now entering on a book, but it's also a history. Robinson Crusoe does the same thing. All of this is increasingly kind of dropped by the time we get to realism, where all it's kind of paired away for the reflective surface of the window on the world as such. Or is it? Anyway, by the time we get to postmodernism, this is all kind of broken down again, right? And we get introductions like this. You're about to begin reading Italo Calvino's new novel, If in a Winter's Night, a Traveller. Relax. Concentrate. Dispel every other thought. Let the world around you fade. Best to close the door. The TV's always on in the next room. Tell the others right away. No, I don't want to watch TV. Raise your voice. They won't hear you otherwise. I'm reading. I don't want to be disturbed. Maybe they haven't heard you with all that racket. Speak louder. Yell. I'm beginning to read Italo Calvino's new novel. Or if you prefer, don't say anything. Just hope they'll leave you alone. Find the most comfortable position, stretch, seated out, curled up or lying flat, flat on your back or on your side, your stomach, in an easy chair, on the sofa, on the rocker, the deck chair, or the hassock. Look at the attention to the position of the reader. Now, is this making the reader comfortable or is it making you uncomfortable? You don't expect this. That's the assumption when you open a novel. You don't want the author to be talking to you like this. You've bought the novel. Get away, right? I just want to go to the bath and read it. Give me the story. Is this the story? Well, think about what it's doing in that respect. It's asking you to be interrogative about what you expect the conventions of a novel form to be, especially an opening, right? So, for example, you can even stand on your head, hands down in the yoga position with the book upside down naturally, right? Now, what is he saying here? Very, very ironically and in a clever fashion, he's ceding authority to you as a reader. You can do what you like, but actually you can you? You're not going to give up. Well, you could just chuck it away, but you're not going to do that. You spent $6.95 or whatever it is on the book, right? But there's a seductive process clearly that's going on here. Of course, the ideal position for reading is something you can never find. In the old days, they used to read standing up at a lectern. People were accustomed to standing on their feet. with it moving. It's not that you expect anything in particular from this particular book. You're the sort of person who, in principle, no longer expects anything of anything. So there's an address to the kind of apparent cynicism or increased meta levels of awareness about what novels are in the long history of novel forms. In a mediatized environment, we're much more aware of how things are produced, sold, perspectivalized, and focused, and so on and so forth. How they're effectively conscious that they're cultural products. So then you notice in a newspaper that if on a winter's night a traveler had appeared, the new book by Italo Calvino, who hadn't published for several years, you went to the bookshop and bought the volume, good for you. In the shop window, you've promptly identified the cover with the title you're looking for. Following this visual trail, you've forced your way through the shop, past the thick barricades of books you haven't read, which were frowning at you from the tables and shelves trying to kill you. But you now know you must never allow yourself to be awed that among them extend for acres and acres the books you needn't read, the books made for purposes other than reading, books read before you open them, since they belong to the category of books read before being written, and thus, and so on, and so on, and so on. So what is it doing now? It's speaking almost in some respects to the actual act of cultural production of the novel form. The commerce of the novel finds its way into the narrative of the novel. If indeed this is the narrative of the novel, because we wait for it when we read it here. We expect a trajectory to begin. Now, those of you that have read Barocca, and of course those of you that are reading Hunger already, know that this is already an issue, right? I mean, what is really the story of Hunger, if you think about it, or the story of Barocca? It's a kind of a wandering and a meeting of people, and nothing really much resolves itself as such. Although, even though we have this kind of strange attenuated ending, no, sorry, not attenuated, it's a strange, very quick ending. Oh yeah, I got on a boat and I went to England in Hunger. It's almost disjunctive with what actually really happens in the experience of the novel and the narrative itself. All right, so we have the author. No, we have the reader in the text. The reader becomes a character. Every novel you've looked at so far on the module has had readers in the text, right? I mean, reading as an activity is something that's, I mean, it's just like watching TV in the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries. It's the same deal, right? The extent to which characters are influenced by that and to which the author of the novel or the narrator of the novel wants to draw your attention towards characters' actions in relation to the reading might be a significant thing, but we don't get anything as explicit as this necessarily. Maybe, and of course, in Madame Bovary, where people try to stop her reading stuff, right, that fills her head full of nonsense, okay? But we think about the ideology of reading and texts and novels and their forceful function and effect on readers by principle of that narrative act, right, that movement where people decided to stop Madame Bovary reading. It might give her ideas. We don't want them. We have a glimpse, then, of a kind of patriarchal society at a particular moment in time. And in a sense, we might say we have a kind of disguised mode of metafiction there. The novel is drawing its attention via the critique of other novels and modes of reading to its own particular influence on the reader, on its reader as such. Okay? So, you know, we might get more of these that just come along, but, you know, don't think that we don't know that you're doing this, right? The most hilarious thing about the frame that's erected, the strange kind of frame that's erected between lecturer and students, right, in lecture theatres, is the notion that for some reason, when we start talking, you lot seem to think that you don't betray anything. So, like, you know, like when I turn around, people go, right? That's fine, obviously, you're allowed. I totally and utterly, you know, you're supposed to do that. But in the age, of course, of wireless technology, there's got to be somebody that's looked up Facebook already, and they're like, all the people with the screens now are like, oh my God, what is he saying? Right? Am I right? You know, we have to deal with this stuff. Look at feel the nervous anxiety. Now, do we get the same thing? Oh, right, okay. Yeah, keep it real, man, right? What a terrible cliche that is, right? Anyway, see, it's worrying, right, because it blows my authority. I mean, I would say, for example, imagine I hadn't put the date for Vonnegut's Breakfast of Champions, 1973, right? Right? Does it say it there? Yeah, 1973. Then one of you immediately looks up Google or Wikipedia or something like that and says, well, he doesn't know much because it was 1974 that novel was published. That's the kind of interactive possibility between students, readers, whatever it might be, and producers these days, right? Anyway. I'm never saying that That was never as much a break as I might be exaggerating it here. This is a different form of metafiction, a related one, right? The author in the text, the author becomes a character. This is from a novel about an author, a sci-fi author called Kilgore Trout, who at one point writes pretty dull sci-fi, and then at one point in the novel meets Kurt Vonnegut, the writer of the novel about Kilgore Trout, who writes novels, right? Are you from the Arts Festival, he said. His eyes rolled and rolled. And this is Vonnegut's voice. I am from the Everything Festival, I replied. The what, he said. I thought it'd be a good idea to let him have a good look at me, and so I attempted to flick on the dome light. I turned on the windshield washers instead. I turned them off again. So the author isn't all-powerful. This is about authority. He's not all-powerful here. But maybe it's a subtle trick to show you that he's being flexible enough, but in some respect, he's still in control. As readers, we're interested in this. Right? Not just narratorial control, but we want to think about the kind of organization that a novel has in order to give it a certain degree of credibility. Anyway, my view of the lights of the county hospital was garbled by beads of water. I pulled at another switch, and it came away in my hand. It was a cigarette lighter, so I had no choice but to continue to speak from darkness. Mr. Trout, I said, I'm a novelist, and I created you for use in my books. Pardon me, he said. I'm your creator, I said. You're in the middle of a book right now, close to the end of it, actually. I laughed there in the dark, tried to turn on the light again, activated the windshield washer again. I don't need a gun to control you, Mr. Trout. All I have to do is write down something about you, and that's it. Are you crazy? He said. No, I said, and I shattered his power to doubt me. I transported him to the Taj Mahal, and then to Venice, and then to Dar es Salaam, and then to the surface of the sun, where the flames could not consume him, and then back to Midland City again. The poor old man crashed to his knees. He reminded me of the way my mother and Bunny Hoover's mother used to act whenever somebody tried to take their photographs. As he cowered there, I transported him to the Bermuda of his childhood, had him contemplate the infertile egg of a Bermuda urn. I took him from there to the Indianapolis of my childhood and put him in a circus crowd there. I had him see a man with locomotor ataxia and a woman with a goiter as big as a zucchini. So we're getting to completely random kind of events here, right? It's seemingly off the top of the head of the novelist who is either in the novel as a character or somehow out of it, stepped out of it completely. Now, what's the effect on you as readers here? We're aware of the conventions of fiction making, or the abilities of fiction making, if you like, but that still doesn't solve the problem. It's more complex than that, surely. This is part of Kurt Vonnegut's Breakfast of Champions. It doesn't sit outside the text in any way. So we're forced to contemplate the way that we read these things, physically, literally, as well as the way that we react to them and think about them. You know, the whole discourse of fiction, or you can immerse yourself in a character, which is kind of like the gamut in some respects, the gambit of realism. Well, that's a problem, right? Because characterization itself is always two-dimensional. It might seem three-dimensional, but that's not the case, right? We know this, and it troubles us somehow, because we invest time in characters, don't we? But when someone says to you, well, look, you know, anything can happen. I can just do this, this, and this, and this. It's a sleight of hand. It's that great Wizard of Oz worry that we have, the disappointment of the curtain being pulled back and the creator suddenly appearing and said it was all a con trick. There is no world of Madame Bovary beyond the Madame Bovary text. Anna Karenina has no backstory. There's no history to Anna Karenina. You might think there is. You might believe in her as a character as such to invest enough in it, but there isn't. Levin is simply Levin as he appears in Anna Karenina. Flat. All characters are flat. Some flatter than others, admittedly, right? Now, what does that mean then? Because if characterization and the organization of logical chronology, narrative, event, action, and effect are all part of the building blocks of the novel form, then for someone to just pull away those chalks and say, well, actually, it's not really that's the case, why do they do it? What's the function of it? There must be some reason for it other than just play, just, you know, dicking around with the novel form. Vonnegut is clearly trying to say something about the way that fiction at some point can do anything, but it spoils dreams and other areas, right? I mean, why would you have a whole series of novels just to do with play? Even play itself, of course, makes us realize about the organization of quote-unquote reality, or the presentation of reality as it might appear. Maybe in capitalism, for example. And many of the novels in the course, of course, the module, of course, are doing this. you know, I would challenge you to go back. I challenge you to go back and read every single one again, right? And look at the amount of eruptive little moments where the narrator seems to confess, or, you know, fissures, if you like, in the metafictionality of each text, where it bubbles to the surface that it's clearly a novel that you're reading, where there's an interest in what the representation is doing, how it's built, how it's made, why it's being talked about at a particular moment in time. So, of course, we have that famous start at the beginning of The Quest, right, where the three different clocks go off from different settings, different types of clocks, too. For what reason, we don't really know. I mean, okay, it builds an atmosphere of anxiety about chronological exactitude, the key thing for novelistic verisimilitude, but it's also trying to do something different, isn't it? Is it speaking to the kind of transitory world, the nighttime world, for example, the achronological world that these characters seem to find themselves in? Is it speaking to the historical, historical flexibility, the fuzziness in history that Spain is in at this particular moment in time, or more exactly, Madrid? Madrid doesn't know what type of city it is. It's not organized in some respect. Is it speaking to the refusal to speak to ordered time, to commit to ordered time, the ordered time of work, for example, of labor routines, the type of time that Germinal has such a problem with, in Spain at this particular moment in time by characters who refuse modernity in some respect, progression? It's doing all that, right? And it's also speaking, of course, about the novel, capital T, capital N, as a form that can be much more expressive and quote-unquote free than we might previously think. Of course, the author regrets the fact that he has no command over this. That's, of course, another Wizard of Oz contract, right? Because, of course, every author, in some respect, has a command over what they write, but not necessarily how it's interpreted. And that's the interesting thing that the Calvino extract shows us. Yeah, there's always a nervousness in some respect that might be sewed into the fabric of a narrative, any narrative, about how it's going to be read, how it's going to be understood, how it's going to be immersed, if you like, or circulated. So we see this, I'm not going to read all of this because I want to look at some other examples, but we see this, of course, in that this passage from the opening of part two of Barocca, where, in a sense, the second paragraph undermines the world of realist description and the world that we have come to expect from a realist novel, and speaks to a whole world outside the novel in terms of the construction and expectations and conventions of the novel form. So the inhabitant of Madrid, who at sometimes find himself by accident in the poor quarters near the Manzanares River, is surprised at the spectacle of poverty and sordidness, of sadness and neglect presented by the environs of Madrid with their wretched rondas, laden with dust in the summer and in winter wallowing in mire. Long, cadenced, authoritative kind of sentences in some respects. Also positioned by, one might expect, well, it appears not the kind of characters that appear in the novel. Certainly a character outside the experience of Manuel, from a higher class, one might say, you know. The inhabitant of Madrid, who sometimes finds himself by accident in the poor quarters, betrays quite a lot about that particular position. The capital is a city of contrast. It presents brilliant light in close proximity to deep gloom, refined life almost European in the center, in the suburbs, African existence like that of an Arab village. Some years ago, not many in the vicinity of the Ronda de Sevilla and of El Campo de Gilimón, there stood a house of suspicious aspect, and of not very favorable repute to judge by popular rumor. So we have a kind of, like, you know, moral judgmental terms, if you like, sewn into the fabric of this opening description. The observer, and then, there's a kind of giving up of this register. It's not going to work in this European city, which is on the periphery of European culture in many respects. It's on a different axis. In this and other paragraphs of the same style, I'd place some hope, for they imparted to my novel a certain. And this is exactly what we've seen already with later postmodern work. You can see exactly the same kind of ideas. For they imparted to my novel a certain phantasmagoric and mysterious atmosphere. The novelist worries about the type of novel that he's going to write. And of course, the stylistic, there's multi-styles in many respects in Barocca, because it's half realism, half modernism in some respects, trying to broach the historically transitional world that itself is finding itself within, right? Arguing that it would be quite in a place in Parisian novel, but not one in dealing with Madrid, not at all. They add, moreover, that here nobody goes astray. not even if one wishes to. Neither are here any observers nor houses of suspicious aspect, not anything else. In resignation, then, I have excised these paragraphs through which I hope someday to be elected to the Spanish Academy. And so I continue my tale in more pedestrian language. So what is he doing here? He's tearing up one blueprint, and he's presenting a different style to proceed. A pedestrian style, one that's much more familiar with the experience of the novel. The novel is less mobile than we might expect, right? It's much more off the streets, as it were. But there's also a consciousness about the fact that, if you think back to Zola, it's a rejection of what stands as conventionally Spanish literature to this point. It refuses those conventions, and it makes a different attempt to locate a different form of Spanish literature, if you guess. And of course, Baroja spectacularly succeeds. I mean, many people read Baroja, and it takes a different aspect altogether. We also have a kind of unevenness, right, that's worked itself into the fabric of the form itself between paragraphs that speaks to the kind of uneven development of Madrid at this particular point. Remember I talked before about the world of spectacular modernity where trains take peasants into the city where the people were feeding on bones. There's still a kind of, people are still watching bullfights. There's this fight between tradition and modernity that's at the very cusp of most of the novels we've read because it's at the very core of ideas about modernity generally. I forget all these things are here. Although, right, maybe I'm just, it's a trick, right? I've done all this before, have I not? That makes you nervous. Why have you got this moustache thing going on with your hair? That's now, we're going to finish. We've got, 10, 12 minutes. We're going to finish by looking at the logical progression of metafiction as it sows itself. And listen, he's all whispering away. I can hear you whispering. I know that you're doing, right? I mean, you're allowed to, of course. No, you're not. I'm marking your essays. I didn't say that. I didn't mean that, people who are listening to this on the historical record. What do we have? We have this movement towards a much more interrogative, restless style, and we can feel that at the incipient moment of modernism. And as I said before, the proto-modernist example of this is the questioning technique that Dostoevsky introduces into Crime and Punishment. It's not a realist novel in the sense that we've been aware of, say, from England or France. It's a much more contested form in that respect. He's much more interested in the way that, in the psychological effects, for example, of the environment around about him, right? And if we think from what we've learned so far by looking at the idea of metafiction, we can see it in the novel itself. This is after he has committed the act, right? I shall call to Razumikin, of course, but not now, says Raskolnikov. I shall call on him another time on the day after I've done it. After that, he's been settled, and when everything is different. Oh, no, sorry, I'm sorry, it's before he's committed the act. And suddenly, he realized what he was saying. After that, he cried, jumping from the seat. But is that to be? Will it really happen? Now, think about this. What this is really doing is speaking to you as a reader when you're reading this purely, say, for fun, when you're reading it as, say, a crime novel. Because you are also thinking at exactly the same thing. Will he really do this? Is he really going to do it? Well, the novel's, it's almost leaping out at you to ask that question. What's the function of that? What's the purpose? Let's carry on. He left the seat and walked away almost at a run. He was about to turn back home, but the idea of going home suddenly appalled him. It was there in that awful cubbyhole of his, in that terrible cupboard, all that had been taking shape in his head for the past month. When people are in a bad state of health, their dreams are often remarkable for their extraordinary distinctiveness and vividness, as well as for their great verisimilitude. We have this shift in register here, don't we, which is almost moving towards the diagnostic. So we feel the authoritative force of, it could be, it's still indirect, it could be Raskolnikov, but we feel an authoritative force of a reader, of a narrator with opinions. Maybe a much more balanced narrator in some respect, but it's also talking about the reality effect of the novel and the narrative within it, because we just don't believe that he's going to do such an incredible act. So the whole picture is sometimes utterly monstrous, but everything about it and the whole process of its presentation are so amazingly plausible. All of the building terms of verisimilitude of the novel and all its details are so delicately etched and unexpected and yet so artistically consistent with everything else in it that the man who is dreaming it could never have invented it in real life were he as great an artist as Pushkin or Turgenev. Good God, he cried. So we move back to this thing. Is it possible that I will really take a hatchet, hit her on the head with it, crack her skull, slither about in warm, sticky blood, break the lock, steal and shake with fear, hide myself all covered in blood and with a hatchet? Good God, is it possible? Well, of course, the answer is yes, right? Because thank God, no. For the sake of the great novel, right? He does it, otherwise it would have been a novella, right? Oh, no, I'm not. Imagine Raskolnikov says, actually, no. I've decided to become a good citizen. It doesn't work that way, does it? Does it? Well, is he not a good citizen? You know, I mean, she kind of deserved it nonetheless. You see what this is doing? It's forcing you as a reader, of course, to read on, right? I mean, it builds tension the same way any good novel does. But it's also kind of betraying itself as a work of fiction. Now, we know that the characters in the novel, people like Porphyry the detective, work on this. They work on those kind of paranoid assumptions and fantasies. But there's a higher level, too, remember, with Dostoevsky's introduction of a kind of form of fantastic realism. This is exactly what we should expect, given the kind of like fantastic world that St. Petersburg has thrown onto its inhabitants. Of course he's going to do this, because it's logical, it's real, it's utterly real. That's the pressures that the metropolis has placed on the citizen. Maybe extreme, of course, but nonetheless, diagnostic within that term, right? Oh, geez, oh, yeah, that's true, actually. So, the extension of this, right, is Knut Hamsun, right? Because, and Hamsun is often read on courses, on modules such as ours, after Dostoevsky, because he tends to extend a lot of Dostoevskian concerns from a different space. It's very important, of course, that Hamsun's novel is first person. There's much more of a kind of like worrying, troublesome, internalized sense of unreality that can come out of the tension of an intellectual, a writer, remember, who's trying to get some kind of like impression upon reality. He can never be a journalist, of course. He's a failed journalist because he can't report the truth as such. And that worries us consistently throughout this restless interrogative narrative. Look at the amount of questions that we see all the time, laced throughout Hamsun's text. What sense could there possibly be to having absolutely all one's most sincere and diligent endeavors come to nothing? ? Why had I written 1848 anyway? Remember, he writes that revolutionary date all the, you know, through the his paperwork. What was that damn dear to me? Here I was walking around so hungry that my intestines were squirming inside me like snakes, and I had no guarantee that there would be something in the way of food later in the day either. I quickened my walk. I didn't stop, not even for a second, but the entire curious decor of the entrance immediately penetrated my consciousness. As I ran up the stairs, the most trifling details of the doors, the ornaments, and the paving stone stood out clearly in my mind's eye. I furiously rang a bell on the second floor. Why did I stop exactly on the second floor? And why grab exactly this bell rope, which was the farthest from the stairway? Why? Now, in the realist angle of the novel, as we try to kind of fit it into credibility, we'll say, well, because he's kind of mad, he's wandering randomly around the streets, ultra hungry, and he's intellectually unsatisfied, right? Box it up, go home, get your 2-1s, get a job and, I'm not going to say that, and have a nice life, right? Finished, fine. Or worry about the fact that it's very reminiscent of the extreme elements of what Vonnegut betrays about the power of fiction. It's all a tissue of kind of like lies and made-upness. Why did he stop on the second floor? Because he just does. And it's a novel. He could have stopped on the third floor. But what you do is you start to hunt for the significance, being literary critics, right, of the second floor, it must mean something. But he's playing around here with his madness, of course, and with a character whose very job is to try to work out what's fictional and what's not. What's delusional, I should say, and what isn't. And of course, what does he do, right? He starts to worry about language itself. Eulalgy, right? He makes up his own vocabulary, this character. How can we possibly trust, it makes us nervous as readers, right? How can we possibly trust a character who's an ultimate liar, starving, an intellectual, a fiction writer, and a loser in many respects? How do we possibly manage this type of experience, of novel? Can we possibly look for a reason, as I'm always doing, right, in the Norway of 1898? Yes. I don't have the time to go into it, but I will at some point. Anyway, I spent myself in variations of these words, and it got to be late evening before my merriment ceased. All he does is he makes up his own terminology, because he can, right? Metafiction shows us that he can. There's a fabulous Gogol short story. I always tell people this because they should read it. It's in the Tales from Mirgorod. Gogol, a Russian writer just of Romantic Realism just before Dostoevsky, about two peasants who are very hungry in the middle of the steppes at a particularly bad moment in the season of harvests. And they go fishing, and they find a fish. And they cook the fish, but they have nothing to cook to light the fire with other than the pages of the book that they're writing down this tale in, and it stops. The story just stops, right? And then we cook. Nothing more happens. Now, that is an automatic perforation of the reality illusion, right, if you think about it, right? For what really has to happen, to fill the bellies, the most material thing that you can possibly get. Now, in many respects, hunger is about that. It's about thinking about the power of the stomach to keep us going. It's the most, I guess, physiologically real thing that we have to deal with on a daily basis. I'm saying this at 1:03, just before lunchtime, right? And then he starts to reflect, of course, on the fate of all this. The fate of my story, he says, filled me with dark forebodings. The more I thought about it, the more absurd it seemed that I could have written it something usable so suddenly. Half asleep at that, my brain full of fever and dreams. I had deceived myself, of course. So there's an insouciant level now where he just doesn't care. Now, where does this leave us as readers? We have these alienated characters trying to see beyond what they would understand to be, quote-unquote, normalized, conventional modes of being. Socially and ontologically, what am I? What's the point of being here? What's the point of how will language tell me somehow something, you know, truthful beyond that which simply can just be represented? That's the kind of tension. I can't answer that tension, but the novels like these are clearly trying to ask questions as severe as that, which is, by the time, you'll see this obviously also in The Dangerous Age, where we have a character who decides, whose whole narrative is written for her by patriarchal social relations, right, but makes a very bold decision before we even arrive at her to absent herself from that, put herself in a completely different space, and begin to reflect on how she herself is represented and how she will go on to represent herself. So representation becomes part of the fabric of her story. It is, after all, a diary, the most intensely personal, apparently truthful modes, right? A fake diary as such. If I had more sensibility, she says, and a little imagination, even as much as Torp, who makes verses with the help of her hymn book, I think it should turn my attention to literature. Women like to wade in the memories as one wades through dry leaves in autumn. I believe I should be very clever in opening a series of whited sepulchres, i.e. books, and without betraying any personalities, I should collect my exhumed mummies under the general title of Women at the Dangerous Age. But besides imagination, I lack the necessary perseverance to occupy myself for long together with other people's affairs. Which is exactly what she does in the novel that you read called The Dangerous Age. She's reflecting in it, on it. Now, that troubles us as much as it can liberate us to peel back what's presented to us as reality and think about what the truly real actually might be. Okay? That's it.